From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Peter Jackson, director of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. The film has been nominated for 13 Academy Awards, including Best Director and Best Picture. Also, photographs from the Vietnam War from the perspective of the North Vietnamese. We talk with Doug Niven. He traveled through Vietnam, tracking down photographers, collecting their pictures for the new book, Another Vietnam. Later, rock critic Ken Tucker considers Johnny Cash's career. Today is Cash's 70th birthday. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Watching Ellie, the new sitcom from Seinfeld co-star Julia Louis-Dreyfus. It premieres tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Enron chief executive Jeffrey Skilling insisted again today that he knew nothing about his company's financial problems when he resigned last summer. His testimony was at odds with that of Enron whistleblower Sharon Watkins. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Skilling and Watkins appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee, sharing the same hearing table, although they never appeared to make eye contact. Watkins said she believed Skilling knew about problems with off-the-books partnerships when he quit the company last summer. Skilling denied that, as he has before, and said he had left Enron because he was burned out after working extremely hard for 10 years. Skilling acknowledged that he had earned millions of dollars from the sale of Enron stock, even as he was persuading Enron employees to keep theirs. But he said he believed he would lose a lot of the money he had made because of the many suits that have been filed against him by Enron shareholders. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, Washington.
The State Department said today that the United States wants to prosecute a suspect in the murder of Daniel Pearl. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan met today with President Pervez Musharraf to discuss the prosecution of an Islamic militant named Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh. Boucher said both the U.S. and Pakistan want to try Saeed, who's accused of masterminding the kidnapping of Pearl, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Angola's president said he believes the rebel movement UNITA is no longer a threat now that its leader, Jonas Savimbi, has been killed. The comments came after talks at the White House with President Bush. NPR's Michelle Kelman reports.
Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos told reporters outside the White House that there's a new possibility for peace in his country. He pledged to work toward a ceasefire and says he expects UNITA to be a political force in the country, though he says it is no longer a military threat. Bush administration officials have been urging the remaining UNITA commanders and the Angolan government to move toward national reconciliation and to get the economy on a sound footing. Along with Angola's president, President Bush met with the leaders of Mozambique and Botswana. They spoke about the HIV/AIDS crisis in sub-Saharan Africa and ways to encourage trade in the region. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
A San Diego man pleaded not guilty today to charges of kidnapping and murder in the disappearance of a 7-year-old neighbor girl. Prosecutors said traces of Danielle Van Damme's blood were found on clothing belonging to David Westerfield. The child's been missing for more than 3 weeks. Westerfield, a 50-year-old engineer, was also charged with possession of child pornography. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 10,115 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 3 points to close at 1,766. This is NPR News. Authorities in Georgia have filed more than 100 new fraud charges against the operator of a rural crematory. Investigators have now found more than 330 corpses on the grounds of the tri-state crematory, which was run by 28-year-old Ray Brent Marsh. A judge ruled today that Marsh was eligible to make bail on the 16 charges he already faced, but he could face rearrest on the new charges. Marsh is accused of taking money for cremations he didn't perform. A Kansas City pharmacist has pleaded guilty to diluting chemotherapy medicine. The plea was part of an agreement with federal prosecutors. Mac Hackworth reports from member station KCUR.
Pharmacist Robert Courtney faced almost 200 years of jail time for diluting chemotherapy drugs. Instead, Courtney could serve anywhere between 17 and a half and 30 years as part of a plea agreement. The agreement forces the pharmacist to tell investigators how many prescriptions he diluted or face more charges in jail time, says U.S. Attorney Todd Graves.
Let's remember that even if we had taken Mr. Courtney to trial and secured his convictions on all 20 counts, he could have gone to prison with his secrets.
What still has to be worked out is how to compensate the victims of Courtney's crimes. More than 300 patients and physicians have sued the pharmacist since charges were filed last August. For NPR News, I'm Matt Hackworth in Kansas City.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says he's closed a Pentagon office that's been accused of proposing to give disinformation to foreign journalists. The Office of Strategic Influence was created after the September 11th attacks to counter the media pronouncements of opponents such as Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. Rumsfeld said he was closing the office because it had been harmed by the media reports. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
In the lands of Middle-earth, legend tells of the Dark Lord Sauron and the ring that would give him the power to enslave the world. Lost for centuries, it has been sought by many, and has now found its way into the hands of the most unlikely person imaginable.
Sir Ian McKellen describing the premise of The Lord of the Rings. The unlikely person put in charge of the ring is the hobbit Frodo Baggins. The trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien was adapted into three films, directed by our guest Peter Jackson. Part 1, The Fellowship of the Ring, has received 13 Academy Award nominations, including Best Film and Best Director. All three films have been shot. Jackson is currently halfway through editing the second film, which will be released around Christmas time. The third film is due out in December 2003. Director Peter Jackson is from New Zealand. He first became known in the States for his 1994 film Heavenly Creatures. His other films include The Frighteners and Meet the Feebles. Peter Jackson spoke with Barbara Bogave, who often guest hosts Fresh Air. Before we hear their interview, let's hear a scene from The Fellowship of the Ring. The wizard Gandalf, played by Ian McKellen, is asking Frodo, played by Elijah Wood, if he can detect anything unusual about the ring.
Can you see anything?
Nothing. There's nothing. Wait. There are markings. It's some form of elvish. I can't read it.
There are few who can. The language is that of Mordor, which I will not utter here.
Mordor?
In the common tongue, it says one ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One ring to bring them all. And in the darkness,
The Lord of the Rings saga is such a monster project, and the plot is so dense and complicated and detailed. Did you have one unifying concept going into making the film that helped you organize such an overwhelming amount of material?
Well, I think the process of adaptation of any book, and I guess The Lord of the Rings is the most extreme example, is really it's simplification, but not simplifying it enough to lose the essence and the spirit of what makes the book great. And obviously The Lord of the Rings requires a little bit more simplification than most books because Tolkien absolutely delighted in the complexity and the detail and going off on tangents and which in the book creates an amazing world. You know, it creates a feeling of this authentic culture and history of Middle Earth, but the actual plot is relatively simple. I mean, the plot of The Lord of the Rings, the spine of the story is obviously about Frodo Baggins, this hobbit who has to carry a ring through many dangers to take it to the one place in Middle Earth, this land where the ring can be destroyed. So really, I mean, we obviously focused on that as being the main plot of the film, and we were very picky about what other extraneous elements of the book we should be including, because the movie, we felt, had to basically be driven by that single storyline.
Did you make a conscious effort to base or ground the movie in some kind of historical feeling or historical fact? Because
sure,
it feels
yeah.
very real, and I think that played
Great.
A part in that.
Good. No, good. I'm saying good because making it real was actually our mantra during the shoot. We felt, I mean, I think a lot of people that haven't read The Lord of the Rings but have heard about it would have assumed that it was set on another planet, that it was like pure fantasy, that was almost like science fiction, you know, that in Middle Earth was another world somewhere else. But that's not the case at all, because Tolkien was really creating a mythic prehistory. He was creating what he described as being events. He was recounting events that took place on Earth in a form of early Europe about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. And so we really took our lead from that. There's a sense that, no, we're not making a fantasy film. What we're doing is we're making much more of an historical film. So we approached the historical element as if we were making Gladiator or Braveheart, you know, from the point of view that you would research ancient Rome or you'd research medieval Scotland if you were making those films. And we had to research the world of Tolkien's Middle Earth as if it really existed. And Tolkien wrote an enormous amount of material about this world, so we were able to investigate the different cultures, because at this time in our history, the world was populated not just by human beings, but by elves and hobbits and orcs and dwarves, and we just approached it as if it was real. We just stopped thinking of it as a piece of fiction.
I thought the evil stuff in the movie was great, that the battles, and there are large epic battles, the lava belching volcanoes of the evil kingdom, and the black robed horsemen are they're hooded, they're riding these huge black sweaty horses. Is it easier to figure out ways to depict evil cinematically in a fantasy than to depict goodness? I notice the hobbits and the elves, they're good too, but they, especially the elves, come off as kind of plain vanilla.
Yeah. The forces of evil, the antagonists in Tolkien's story, there's both the good and bad side to that, because you do have some very potent, visually interesting creatures like the orcs and like the Black Riders. I mean, there's something, because it is interesting, because I agree with you that the Black Riders, who are the ring wraiths, who are these creatures that hunt for the ring, they are nothing more. I mean, it's the image of the Reaper, really. It's the black, faceless cow, you know, robed creatures who, there's something that just is scary about those sorts of characters. You don't need to make them incredibly over-designed, or, you know, it's just the simplicity of it is scary. But so we had that, and we had the orcs, and we had, obviously, Christopher Lee plays a wonderful character who represents really most of the views of the antagonist. But the fundamental problem with The Lord of the Rings that we are continuing to confront as we move into the second and third film is the fact that the main baddie, Sauron, manifests himself as a giant flaming eyeball. And now, in a movie, if you were writing a movie from scratch, just an original movie, you would never choose to have your villain be a giant flaming eyeball. It has certain limitations. Has certain limitations to it, and so we do have to grapple with that. It comes across incredibly well on the printed page as this, you know, very ethereal concept that is actually quite chilling. But in the movie, it's you just have to be very, very careful how you depict that stuff.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be careful with a lot of this stuff, this kind of pseudo-medieval fantasy. So much can go wrong. They can almost seem a parody of themselves. And there is, in fact, a parody of Lord of the Rings already. I believe it's called Board of the Rings. And the only line,
I've seen it. I've never read it. I've deliberately avoided it because I thought it would contaminate me too much.
Oh, really? That can happen.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You shot all three films back to back. How did you do that? Did you shoot them as three separate movies in your own mind, in the organization, or as one long one and thinking you'd break them up in post-production?
Well, we shot them as one long one. We had three screenplays, so we definitely wrote and structured three separate movies so that they had a beginning, middle and end in themselves. And so that's how the scripts were, three separate scripts. But once we started shooting the stuff, we really just didn't think too much about, you know, film one, film two, film three. We just scheduled it and shot it as if it was one continuous film. And we were always jumping around. We didn't just stick to one movie. You know, on a Monday, we might be shooting something from film three. On a Tuesday, we'd be back to doing a scene from film one, you know, film two on Wednesday. It was just very intermittent. And we also had, the other thing is we had multiple units shooting. So so I might be directing a piece of drama with the actors from film two, and on the same day, there might be a battle scene being photographed by the second unit that was from film three. So we'd be looking at footage each night, you know, and even the footage that we looked at on a single day was spread around the three different movies. So it was done very much out of sequence, and with us really just thinking of it as one, you know, probably 9-hour-long movie.
There's some amazing landscapes in the film, locations shot in your native New Zealand. The evil empire of Mordor is always depicted with active volcanoes and black mountains, yes, and ominous rocky terrain. Where did you film that?
Most of the Mordor scenes were filmed on Mount Ruapehu, which is a genuine active volcano that's in the middle of the North Island.
I believe you had ski lifts that shuttled the crew up and down.
We shot during summer, because during winter it's a ski resort and it's covered in snow, obviously. But during summer the snow's thawed away, so we got the resort to activate the ski lifts for us, so we could shuttle people around. Yeah. Mm.
Did it get a bit toasty there?
It was rugged. I mean, it's volcanic rock. It actually got. It was actually very hard, and, you know, people would get lots of cuts and bruises because it's that kind of rock that's hard to walk on, and it was all very sharp and pretty dangerous, yeah.
What was the hardest terrain you filmed in, or the roughest shoot?
Well, we did quite a few scenes where we had to helicopter people in, because we looked around for the most stunning locations we could find, and often these obviously don't happen to conveniently be next door to a road. Or near a hotel, you know, they're obviously very wild and rugged, and we flew around in helicopters, found these places, interesting rock formations, and there's scenes in the first film, there's a scene where they have to hide from a swarm of crows that have been sent out to look for them, and they hide under the rocks as the crows fly overhead, and that was shot in a place where we could only fly everybody in and all the gear in and choppers, so we had four or five choppers just ferrying people up and down the hill with all the equipment. That particular scene because it was also dangerous to some degree, because these are quite high rugged mountains, and we'd always have to take survival kits up so that if in the event that the clouds suddenly came in and we didn't have time to get people off the mountain, there would be a possibility of having to stay overnight with it, you know, just like sleep there. So we always had the survival rations. We had Primus, you know, stoves. We had sleeping bags. We always had that stuff available in case we ever got stuck up there. But fortunately, it never happened.
You know, Tolkien fans are so dogged and diehard. Were you ever dogged by them during shooting? Did they ever show up?
Well, surprisingly not. Not really. Occasionally there'd be somebody hiding in the bushes with a camera. And you'd get home at night, you'd go onto the net, and you'd see a photo of yourself from sometime during that day shooting the scene, and someone had been hiding, snapping pictures. But they genuinely didn't really make themselves visible. We didn't really have situations where we had much problem from the fans. I think helped by the fact that we were obviously down in New Zealand shooting, so we were fairly isolated. But it was a unique experience, because normally, I mean, I'm used to making films in New Zealand, other films I've made, where, you know, no one has a clue what you're doing. They're original screenplays. You shoot your movie, no one knows anything about it, and then you know you take the film to Cannes, one of the film festivals, and then you've got to work really hard to make people even aware of the existence of the film. And in this situation, it was almost the extreme opposite, where we'd go to work every day, you know, doing shooting over this 15-month period, and we were acutely aware that there were millions of people who were watching and listening for any information about what we were shooting on that day. But which was actually a positive. I mean, ultimately, I thought it was a very positive thing, because getting through 15 months of shooting is obviously a very arduous process, and that the presence of the fans, the presence of the interest of the fans, of this incredible excitement and anticipation that was out there for the last two or three years, we all felt every day that we'd better deliver the best possible film that we could make.
I'm talking with filmmaker Peter Jackson. His new movie, Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, has 13 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture, Director, and Screenplay. We'll talk more, Peter, after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New Zealand filmmaker Peter Jackson. His new film, Lord of the Rings, has tallied 13 Academy Award nominations. Jackson's other films include The Frighteners and Heavenly Creatures. You grew up in a small town in New Zealand. I think I read the nearest movie theater was a bit of a drive away. You started trying to make movies when you were just 9 or 10 years old. What got you into it?
Watching the original King Kong on TV, the 1933 King Kong, which I watched when I was 9 or 10 years old. There's a lot of that movie that really inspired The Lord of the Rings in a funny kind of way, too, because it swept me away. It was escapism. It took me from my seat into the world of the film. I was transported, which is what great movies do to you. Obviously, if you're in the audience and you just forget you're sitting in your chair and you go into the film and participate in the movie. And I loved what King Kong did to me, and I just thought, it's the magic of film. This is what I want to do. I had a disadvantage because New Zealand at that time, you know, we weren't making movies. You know, there was no feature films whatsoever being made in New Zealand, hence there was no film industry, there were no film schools. And so I ended up, my parents had a Super 8 movie camera and for taking home movies, and so I ended up grabbing that. It's obviously the days before video cameras, but Super 8 was kind of the video version, the film version of what video cameras are today. And so I'd be filming little movies with my Super 8 camera all the way through my teenage years, and they got more sophisticated.
Well, what were your childhood early movies like?
Well, they were little 5-minute things, 2-minute things. They were like clay monsters, clay dinosaurs that I'd animate, stop-motion animation on the kitchen table. I got friends together to do a World War II movie at some stage, digging a trench in my parents' back garden and putting up with sandbags and barbed wire and making a sort of a little war movie. Horror movies, I made a vampire film, zombie film. I made, and these are like, you know, they were usually quite short. I when I was at school, I made a Monty Python sort of parody, because I started to love Monty Python's Flying Circus, the TV show, which was screening in the late 60s, early 70s. Then by the time I was 20, I had a 16mm camera, and I started to make a movie in the weekends with my friends. And I was in the movie, I directed it, I did camera work most of the time. I built all the monsters. It was a science fiction horror film called Bad Taste. And after 4 years of shooting basically on Sundays, we had a feature film, and then the New Zealand Film Commission took that to the Cannes Film Festival, and it literally was a home movie. But it was, you know, it was finished with soundtrack and music, and it was an hour and a half long, and they took it to Cannes, I think, in 1988, and it sold. It sold to like 30 countries in the space of a few days at Cannes, and was regarded as being highly successful by the New Zealand Film Commission, who then obviously wanted me to make more of these, or they were sort of prepared to support me. So suddenly we had the government, because the New Zealand Film Commission is like a government-funded agency, so suddenly we had the government making horror films, funding horror films in New Zealand, which I always found quite amusing. And so I made Meet the Feebles, which was a really outrageous sort of adult puppet film.
I have to interrupt you here, because Meet the Feebles, I have a description of it that I'm I just have to read. A backstage musical that rivals Springtime for Hitler for aggressive tastelessness. Feebles is cast entirely with puppets and actors in foam rubber animal suits. The plot involves the efforts of a third-rate vaudeville animal troupe to land a syndicated television series. Backstabbing, gluttony, drug overdoses, and interspecies lust are the order of the day.
that's a fair description.
Enough said. It is just so hard, though, to imagine that the folks at New Line Cinema gave you, Peter Jackson, the director of Meet the Feebles, $270 million to make three movies about based on the most revered work of literature.
It's a mystery. I mean, Heavenly Creatures, which was a film that I made a few years ago, That in a way broke me out of the horror mold and gave me some legitimate sort of art house attention, and that, you know, I think when people saw that they realised that I was capable of doing a little bit more than just sort of special effects stuff. I mean, Lord of the Rings was made as a low budget independent film. I mean, it was, because we made it in New Zealand. We made it with a lot of the same crew that I've used on my other movies. The same kind of infrastructure. We made it the New Zealand way, not the Hollywood way. And, you know, what that enabled us, because obviously it wasn't low budget, we still shot it as a low budget film, and so all that surplus money could go straight onto the screen. So we were able to build enormous sets and have hundreds of extras and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of computer shots and all the wonderful costumes. You know, we had, that's where all our money got spent, which we'd never been able to do before. Obviously, making low-budget films, you just can't spend money on any of that stuff. So now we had all the money that we needed to bring this world to life.
Is there now a Hobbit Village amusement park in Wellington, New Zealand, or something like that? Does this live on in ancillary marketing?
There should be. I mean, the Hobbit Village, you know, the Hobbit Village was absolutely amazing. I mean, people can see it in the movie. It was the most beautiful thing. We built the Hobbit Village a year before shooting commenced because I wanted all the grass to grow, and we planted real vegetables like carrots and Brussels sprouts and cabbages in the gardens of the Hobbits, and we had gardeners doing the gardening so that over a year everything sprouted and germinated, and it was just amazing. And then we shot there for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I think we shot there, and we finished, and it all got bulldozed down. It all got returned back to farmland again, and it was sad. I mean, we all said, why can't this be kept? Why can't people come to visit the Hobbit Village when the film comes out? And we actually all feel really bad about that. But one of the problems with film sets in themselves is that they're never built to last, and so, you know, it was built sort of to do the job for the film, and it would start falling to pieces if tourists started to climb all over it, you know. So,
well, Peter Jackson, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Director Peter Jackson speaking with Barbara Bogave. His film, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, is nominated for 13 Academy Awards. Jackson is currently halfway through cutting the second film in the trilogy. It's due out in December. Part 3 is scheduled for release in December 2003. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Years of Rice and Salt, a novel by Kim Stanley Robinson, author of The Mars Trilogy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, pictures from the Vietnam War from the other side. We talk with Doug Niven about tracking down pictures taken by North Vietnamese photographers and collecting them in a new book. Also, David Bianculli reviews the new sitcom Watching Ellie, and Ken Tucker considers Johnny Cash's career on the occasion of Cash's 70th birthday. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Richards and Jason Alexander returned to TV after Seinfeld with their own sitcoms, but both shows flopped. Now another Seinfeld alumnus, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, is trying to move from supporting player to star. Her new sitcom, Watching Ellie, begins tonight. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Almost every discussion of Watching Ellie, the new NBC sitcom starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, invokes what it calls the Seinfeld curse. It's based on the idea that someone coming from a hugely successful TV sitcom is unlikely to succeed in a second hit show. In this way of thinking, that's why Michael Richards, who played Kramer on Seinfeld, flopped in NBC's The Michael Richards Show. It's why Jason Alexander, who played George Costanza, flopped in ABC's Bob Patterson. It's even why Patrick Warburton, who played Elaine's face-painting boyfriend on Seinfeld, didn't succeed in the Fox superhero comedy, The Tick. But that's nonsense. There is no Seinfeld curse. There's just the general curse of television itself, which is that most shows fail, and it's hard enough to make a good show, much less a different and daring one like Seinfeld. The Michael Richards Show failed because it was an awful, ill-conceived sitcom. So was Bob Patterson. Both shows were built around strong comic personalities, but built with no sense of purpose or design. But that has nothing to do with a curse or with Seinfeld. A few years ago, NBC failed horribly with an unfunny sitcom starring Nathan Lane, just before he starred in The Producers. How do you make an unfunny sitcom starring Nathan Lane? Now that's a curse. Besides, The Tick was a funny and very different kind of comedy. It just didn't catch on. And over on HBO, the co-creator of Seinfeld, Larry David, has both starred in and written Curb Your Enthusiasm, a comedy so funny and bold and clever that I really do think it's the best sitcom since, well, since Seinfeld. Maybe it seems so fresh in part because David wasn't on camera in Seinfeld. But a Seinfeld curse? No way. Which brings us, finally, to Watching Ellie. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, instead of playing a single, high-strung New Yorker named Elaine, plays a single, high-strung Los Angeles nightclub singer named Ellie. The show's central gimmick is that each episode follows her for 22 minutes of her life in real time, interrupted only by commercials. A clock in the lower left corner counts down the moments to zero, like the Fox drama series 24 in reverse, and without the tension. With Louis-Dreyfus in the leading role, the supporting characters are a mixture of credible and cartoonish. The buffoons are Steve Carell from The Daily Show as an annoying ex-boyfriend, and Peter Stormare as a Kramer-like building super. The more quietly drawn characters are Darren Boyd as Ellie's current boyfriend and Lauren Bowles as her sister. In real life, the two actresses are sisters as well. And behind the scenes, Watching Ellie is created and written by Brad Hall, who is Louis-Dreyfus' husband. More to the point, he's also the creator of the lifeless sitcom, The Single Guy. Now, Watching Ellie is much better than The Single Guy, and much, much better than the sitcom starring Richards and Alexander. It's no Curb Your Enthusiasm, and no Seinfeld, but it grows on you. When Carell, as ex-boyfriend Edgar, chases down Ellie on the street, the dialogue is loopy enough to be entertaining. And for Ellie, who's late for work, the clock is ticking, literally.
Ellie! Ellie!
Edgar!
God, Ellie, Ellie! Oh.
Well,
wow.
I guess this was inevitable, huh?
What?
Well, you break up. Sooner or later, you're going to run into each other.
Well, we didn't run into each other exactly. You chased me down the street.
Okay, let's try not to make this, like, totally awkward.
Oh. Oh, hi.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi. So, how you doing, Elle? You okay?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, Edgar. I'm actually doing better than fine.
Really?
Yeah.
You seem tense.
Mm. No, I'm just a little late. Oh, wow, I'm really late.
Oh, that's fast.
Well, I'm still late.
Is that why you look so frazzled?
I don't look frazzled.
Yeah, you do.
No, I don't. Please don't say I look frazzled when I absolutely do
not. Okay, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay, wow, my mistake. To me, you looked a little frazzled and tired.
Okay. Do you see? Do you see? This is what you do, Edgar.
Well, I didn't say you look bad.
What, frazzled and tired isn't bad?
No, okay.
The first two shows end with Ellie on stage, singing.
It's during these last moments that the actress succeeds in creating a character fully separated from Elaine. Elaine would sing about as well as she danced. Ellie is worth listening to, just as watching Ellie on its own merits is worth watching. If you want daring and different television, though, I want to steer you towards 6 Feet Under, which begins its second season this Sunday on HBO. This very dark comedy drama about a family-run funeral home really came into its own about 5 episodes into last year's run, and this show's first 4 episodes, sent for preview, have left me desperate for more. Forget all the talk about TV curses. There are blessings, too, and 6 Feet Under definitely is one of them. Watching Ellie is an option. Watching 6 Feet Under is mandatory.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, pictures of the Vietnam War taken by North Vietnamese photographers. This is Fresh Air. There are several now famous photographs from the war in Vietnam that have helped create our collective memory of the war, such as the picture of the young Vietnamese girl running naked, her clothes burned off by napalm. Doug Niven has found the photos from the other side, pictures taken by North Vietnamese photographers. With a couple of exceptions, these are pictures that haven't been seen before in America. Most of these photos were never even published in North Vietnam. Nixon made 16 trips to Vietnam to find photographers and photo archives. The pictures he collected are now on exhibit at the International Center of Photography in New York, and they're collected in the new book, Another Vietnam, Pictures of the War from the Other Side. Niven is a photojournalist who worked in Cambodia from 1992 to 95. One of the most interesting photos, I think, in your book is one that was never published. It's a 1970 photo of a makeshift operating room that's actually in the middle of a swamp. It's not really a room, it's just outdoors in the middle of a swamp. Would you describe the photo?
Sure. There's a few doctors in their smocks and with their mouths covered, and they're in a kind of a tent canopy, which is a mosquito net, and a patient with a very serious head wound is being carried in to be operated on in this, right in the middle of a swamp. It's really an incredible picture.
And the person bringing in the stretcher and the doctors and nurses, they're all standing in water above their ankles.
Yeah, I mean, they really had to work in very difficult conditions. And the interesting thing about this picture to me was the fact that the photographer never printed that himself. He didn't think this was particularly remarkable. So when I first saw that picture, I saw it in a very small size. I just looked at it, and the whole picture just opened up. It was a whole story inside that picture.
Who is the photographer?
His name's Vo An Khang, and he lives way down south in the farthest tip of the southern peninsula in Vietnam. And he never really worked for anybody. He kind of took pictures during the war almost as a hobby, so he really had this very interesting collection of pictures.
What else was in the collection?
It was mostly pictures of Viet Cong and just and the challenges they faced, the difficulties families had. They had to live in mangrove swamps because they were trying to hide from American bombing.
What motivated him to take these photos if they weren't being published?
Well, what was interesting about him was is in the 50s, in the late 50s, his family had a photo business. They had a photo shop in Bac Lieu, which is in southern part of Vietnam. And when the war came to their village in 1960, they had to close up shop, and he just took it. He felt a sense of purpose that he just had to take pictures of what was happening. It was just such a disgrace to his morals that the business was destroyed, that their village was being attacked, and that everything they had to go through. So he just felt a real sense that he had to capture this particular moment in time.
Another photo that you reprint in your book is it's a picture of the downed U.S. Navy pilot Robert Shoemaker being walked by militiamen after they've captured him. This is a very upsetting photo to American eyes. How was this photo used in North Vietnam?
Well, what's interesting is the way that picture's printed in the book, you can actually see the full frame, and on that frame you can see some slight marks, and those were the cropping marks that the photographer wanted, how the picture to be cropped. So he wanted that picture just to be shown with that one militiaman and the American pilot Robert Shoemaker, when in fact there was this larger group. So that's how they wanted the picture to be seen, and it was kind of like a trophy picture, really, showing that they'd captured this American pilot, and they love to have very small soldiers with guns standing next to very big American pilots. It made them feel proud and strong when they saw pictures like that.
So they wanted to crop just one-on-one so that this one North Vietnamese soldier would seem so much stronger and braver?
Yeah, I think so. And I actually think the more interesting picture is the full frame, because it shows you the surroundings and it gives you an idea of what the conditions were like that day, because he'd been shot down a half an hour before that picture was taken.
Were a lot of the photos that you found propaganda photos where the people are actually posed?
Oh, there's lots of pictures like that, and the Vietnamese love to put those down on the table to show me those first. They seem to like those pictures the most, but I have a real aversion to that type of picture, and in the end, I also thought it was important to include a few of those in the book because it's part of the story. But yeah, they really like the propaganda picture, but I think they don't resonate very well, and they don't stand up to time very well either.
Did you come across any photographers who prided themselves on the fact that they took unposed shots and that they were where the action was?
Oh, sure. There's a few photographers that fit that billing. One photographer was the Army photographer, and he has a lot of pictures in the book. His name's Doan Cong Ting, and his nickname by his friends was the King of the Battlefield. And in the middle of battles, he would stand up and take pictures. And when he was a young photographer, he'd heard this famous quote from Robert Capa saying, if the picture's not good enough, you got to get closer to the picture. So he'd stand right up in the middle of battles with a 50-millimeter lens and shoot pictures.
It's interesting that he would be inspired by this comment from an American photographer while his people were fighting the Americans.
Yeah, and also don't forget that Robert Capa was killed in North Vietnam in the early 50s during the French period.
Good point. Did you find any pictures taken in the tunnels, like the Cu Chi tunnels, where North Vietnamese soldiers lived and worked out of the sight of American soldiers?
Yeah, there's one picture in the book of the actual digging of these tunnels. There's also another picture in the book. There was a very similar tunnel complex up north, right just north of the DMZ in a place called Vinh Loc. And that was a big tunnel complex too. So that was a very important part of the war for them. And pictures inside that really showed the difficulties for the Vietnamese well.
Did the photographers talk at all about the difficulty of photographing from within the tunnels without any natural light?
Yeah, in fact, one photographer had a very novel way to shoot pictures inside these tunnels. None of them really had a flash, so what he did was he emptied a bullet and gathered the gunpowder, and he lit the gunpowder and so it would flash, and he has this wonderful picture of some women singing inside one of the tunnels, just lit with gunpowder from a bullet.
What were some of the other technical problems that these photographers were up against?
Well, one of the most incredible things for me was hearing their stories about being trained in Hanoi for 6 months, and they had very extensive training. They were instructed to strip apart cameras in the dark, and they had very good training. And then when their training was finished, they were given a camera, usually with just one lens, like I said, and then they were sent down the Ho Chi Minh Trail for 3 months. And right as they were sent, just before they were sent on this long trip, they were given two rolls of film.
Well, you have to make every shot count if you're doing that.
They did, and often I would look on their rolls of film and I would see one picture and the next picture was taken several hundred miles away, and the next picture was several hundred miles away from that. So they really had to make each picture count.
The photographers you were talking about who were told to, you know, take two rolls of film and then come back, were these people who were on assignment from the state?
Yeah, those guys were state photographers working for the government news agency, and their pictures were generally used in a few official publications.
So did these photographers have to go after more, like only photos that made the North Vietnamese look victorious?
Yeah, typically I think those photographers took some of the least interesting stuff, to be honest. Their pictures were very much geared for this propaganda element. The really interesting pictures were taken by the Army photographer and by another photographer in the North who specifically focused on daily life in the North during the war. And he just had very beautiful pictures of very natural scenes of what life looked like during that wartime.
One of the photographers who you spoke with had been the official photographer for Ho Chi Minh. How did he get that position?
Actually, he's still alive, too. He's a really interesting guy. He was a young peasant from really far out in the sticks in the North. And during the 40s, just following World War II, he was hanging out with the young revolutionaries, Ho Chi Minh being one of them. And he was asked to take pictures of them. And it was as simple as that. And after that, he became Ho Chi Minh's personal photographer. And during the war, too, he traveled down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and did a long story on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which in the end, he lost 100 rolls of film. He lost everything. He 6 months of work during a bombing, and he has a very vivid description of seeing all his film strung up in all the trees, hanging from the branches in little strips.
Would we recognize any of the photos he took of Ho Chi Minh?
Well, there's a very famous picture he took of Ho Chi Minh sitting at a desk outside signing letters. I think that's one of the real icons from Vietnam, and this is one of his pictures.
One of the last photos in your book is taken on the outskirts of Saigon on April 30th, 1975, and there's just like dozens of combat boots in the street. Would you describe the photo and what's happening?
Well, this is like a state, the National Highway 1 out of Saigon, and it's just littered with army boots and uniforms. The South Vietnamese soldiers that were there on April 30th, 1975, as soon as they heard that North Vietnamese were invading the town, Saigon, they just stripped off their uniforms and took off their boots as quickly as they could, because if they had been caught wearing those, they'd be likely shot or punished. So it's just an incredible scene of this highway just littered with boots and uniforms.
Who took the photo?
A guy named Zhuang Thanh Phong. And he was the Cu Chi tunnel photographer as well. And he didn't have a lot of pictures, but the few pictures he did have were very good.
What kind of condition were most of the photos in when you found them?
Actually, a real variety of conditions. Some of the negatives were in absolute pristine shape. The photographer kept the film and still keeps the film in an old American ammunition case. Inside he has roasted rice, which keeps the humidity out, and he buries this box underground, and this is what he did during the war, too. And his negatives look like they were made yesterday. They're so perfect. Another photographer, this army photographer, his negatives were in terrible shape. He brought me bags, plastic bags full of film that he'd kept in his bathroom, right under the bathroom sink. And I had to go through these bags of film and hold the film up to light and look at these very dusty, moldy pieces of film that were just falling apart. So we had from excellent to terrible.
Were you able to use any of those moldy films?
Yeah, it's amazing what you can actually do with film like that. You can clean the film, you can flatten it, you can straighten it out, and sometimes you see the marks of the pictures. Some of the pictures in the book have marks like this, but I don't think it hurts the image itself.
For the photographers who weren't working for the state and were just working for themselves, how would they develop their film?
These guys would wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, camped out along the side of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they carried a little tea saucer in their backpack, and they would mix the chemistry by hand with water from a stream, and they would process the roll of film in the dark of the night. And they joked about it, saying they had the world's biggest dark room. And they would process their film under the stars, and in the middle of the night when it was quiet, and they would wash the film in the stream And in the morning, they'd have their finished pictures.
Doug Niven is the co-editor of the new book, Another Vietnam, Pictures of the War from the Other Side. Those photos are also in the current exhibition at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan. Coming up, pop music critic Ken Tucker considers Johnny Cash on Cash's 70th birthday. This is Fresh Air. Country singer Johnny Cash turned 70 today. To celebrate his birthday, a 2-CD collection called The Essential Johnny Cash has just been released. In March, Columbia Records will reissue 5 Cash albums from the late 50s through the mid-60s. And in June, a tribute album featuring covers by artists including Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen will be released. Rock critic Ken Tucker considers Cash's career.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Johnny Cash wrote and first recorded a studio version of that song in the late 50s when he was signed to Sun Records as a rockabilly singer. But unlike his label mates Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins, Cash didn't have much of a feeling for rock and roll. Raised on gospel music and a fan of Western swing, he hooked up with guitarist Luther Perkins and bassist Marshall Grant, the so-called Tennessee Two, to create a sound. No fiddles, no pedal steel. Perkins used one hand to deaden his guitar strings and played triplets that rose to meet Cash's sinking baritone. The result was a rhythm so elemental that Cash has played variations on it ever since.
On this heart of mine, I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Johnny Cash gradually went from rockabilly hellraiser to founder of a liberal wing in country music. He married June Carter Cash in 1968, had Bob Dylan on the first edition of his ABC TV show in 69, and as for why he became known as the Man in Black, well, he told us why himself in 1971.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town.
I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time. I wear the black.
Cash has always been a man in whom opposites attract. Piously devout, he's recorded a lot of religious music, and one of the reissues, Hymns by Johnny Cash from 1959, was promoted by Columbia Records as the album he came here to record, a reference to Sam Phillips' disinclination to record anything by Cash on Sun that wasn't rockabilly. On the other hand, Cash has a wild streak he's done nothing to hide. He gulped speed. In 64, he was arrested for possessing 688 capsules of dexedrine. And Cash, in live performance, could achieve the sort of ferocity that justifies the melodramatic declaration of the character in Folsom Prison Blues, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die." But then again, for a poker face in black, Cash is also painfully fond of mediocre novelty songs. Not just his 1969 number one hit, A Boy Named Sue, but also stuff like Everybody Loves a Nut and Look at Them Beans. I'll spare you those and play what I think is his best, certainly his least sentimental song ever, from when he was first starting out in 1955.
Everybody knows where you go when the sun goes down. I think you only live to see the lights uptown. I wasted my time when I would try, try, try. 'Cause when the lights have lost their glow, you cry, cry, cry. Soon your sugar daddies will all be gone. You wake up some cold day and find you're alone. You'll call for me, but I'm gonna tell you bye, bye, bye. When I turn around and walk away, you'll cry, cry, cry. You're gonna cry, cry, cry.
These days, Cash has been weakened by respiratory ailments that keep him from performing. He's going to get a lot of salutes, and the company putting out his reissues is being overly generous. Believe me, when you've heard one Johnny Cash train song, you don't need to hear a whole album of them. Since he's always appreciated forthrightness, I'll be blunt. Cash has gotten credit for more than he deserves, but you've got to like a guy who can parlay a flat voice and flattened guitar strings into a good reputation and a marriage that's always seemed better than good. Happy birthday, Mr. Cash.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with animator and director John Lasseter. He's the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.